ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For 50 years, NAIDOC Week has honoured and elevated the voices of First Nations communities, grounded in culture and strong in identity. This NAIDOC Week, celebrate Black excellence with programs like Away, Speaking Out, and Word Up. As we mark 50 years of Deadly, this week and every week, right here on ABC Radio National.
Hi, it's Natasha Mitchell. Today on Big Ideas, can writing change the world? In the face of censorship and cancellations, book shreddings and more, it's a question many writers have been really wrestling with in the past few years, including one of Australia's best.
As a writer, I think I have limited ability to have any serious impact. I'm sceptical of that. I said to the schools group here on Friday, yeah, when people say things like, does writing change the world? I used to think that, and then what you would realise, and historically any older people would realise, it only takes one or two men who are mad to really do serious damage to the whole world. And yeah, your writing is up against that incredibly powerful, regressive, violent forces, so it's a very difficult...
Good to see you're still demotivating rooms of students, Tony. That's...
Yeah.
Don't be demotivated. Tony Burch has plenty of galvanising things to say today on Big Ideas, and he's also sharing incredible stories from the 1800s and beyond about Aboriginal women whose letters, courageous letters to authorities, are amongst the most powerful acts of writing he's come across. Writers, writing, writers' festivals, they've certainly been at the front lines and amongst the biggest casualties of recent battles over free speech. So what is the role of the writer at this moment? How can writers write with courage? Are there times when they should just stay silent? Yeah, and what responsibilities do we have as readers? Tony Burch is an historian, activist, an award-winning writer, a poet, an essayist of Aboriginal, Irish and Barbadian descent, whose books include Women and Children, Ghost River and The White Girl, a novel about the stolen generations which is widely taught now in Australian high schools. He's also the Boisbouvier Chair in Australian Literature at the University of Melbourne, and this is his powerful closing night address on the ethical imagination given at this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival on the lands of the Kulin Nations. Later he'll join the editor of the monthly magazine and his former student, as it happens, Michael Williams.
I'm hesitant to begin, as some of what I will talk about tonight I expect to contradict before I finish speaking. If I wanted to be clever, I might call this a strategically counterintuitive delivery. But if I'm honest, maybe it will get a little messy. To be more sympathetic to myself, we live in uncertain and chaotic times. In the last few years, I've asked more serious questions of myself than at any time in my life, but have produced fewer answers. So let's get going and see where we end up. The idea of an ethical imagination is not an original idea of mine. I was introduced to the concept by the Turtle Island First Nations scholar, Dwayne Donald, in his televised lecture on What Terms Can We Speak? For First Nations communities to engage in ethical conversations with settler Canadians, Donald believes that only by bypassing recalcitrant settler reactionaries determined to maintain violent, inequitable relationships against First Nations peoples can an equitable space of dialogue commence. It is also important to recognise that Margaret Sullivan deals with the concept at length in her influential work, The Ethical Imagination, to which I am greatly indebted. I'll return to the concept of an ethical imagination and its relationship to writers and readers several times during this conversation. Let me begin with the assistance of two major Aboriginal writers born around 150 years apart. In 2016, Alexis Wright, the multi-award-winning novelist and poet, published a seminal essay, What Happens When You Tell Someone Else's Story. In the essay, Wright lamented the extent to which our First Nations writing, our stories, have been forgotten, willfully erased from the public record, and white consciousness both, or perhaps worse still, stolen and reproduced for public consumption and profit. Wright has reflected on the damage that narrative theft has done to First Nations communities across Australia. She writes, "We don't get much of a chance to say what is right or wrong about the stories told on our behalf, which stories are told or how they are told. It just happens and we have to deal with the fallout." Some readers of the essay have misread it as a demand for self-censorship amongst white writers. For instance, a distraught novelist complaining to me for championing the essay at a literary festival grabbed hold of their own throat with both hands and pleaded, "If anyone dare interferes with my right to produce whatever art I choose, I will suffocate." I suggested the first thing the writer do was to stop attempting to choke themselves. I then asked that they consider that the long history of theft of First Nations stories and fictions posing a fact that misrepresent us ad nauseam, these lies have historically traumatised our communities with the demonisation of our people as a defence of deaths in custody and the fantasies that justify the theft of our children being two of many examples. In What Happens When You Tell Someone Else's Story, Wright asks us to seriously consider our responsibility as writers and storytellers. When we write, when we are read, we have a responsibility to the power of storytelling, to be fully aware of the privilege of becoming a published author. Wright is not interested in a separatist approach to writing and reading. In fact, she reads as widely as any writer I know, appreciating and being influenced by global literature. She is a believer in equitable inclusion. The extent of her generosity towards non-Aboriginal people was highlighted in a second essay where she wrote that she wanted to know people far away from us and hear their stories. Wright expressed concern for what settler Australians, migrants and refugees leave behind in their homelands when they come to live on Aboriginal country. She wants to know if new arrivals are accompanied by their ancestors, the custodians of traditional stories from other parts of the world, stories that nurture the generations that come after them now and into the future. If your ancestors did not come to this land with you, you lack the protection of their stories. I want to pause and consider the depth of an ethical imagination that underpins Wright's reflection. She has asked the question that, to my knowledge, no other writer in Australia has posed. And she has done so, I believe, because she cares deeply about the interconnections between all of us, wherever we come from, whatever damage we have done to others, or the extent to which we have suffered from the actions of others. 150 years before Alexis Wright began her writing life, a Wurundjeri Willem man, the senior clan leader, Bill Baleri, reminded the new arrivals on Kulin Country in a poem that members of the Aboriginal nation and the white strangers both were interconnected in life and death. Towards the end of his own life in 1846, Billa Baleri, who as a young man had been present at the John Batman Treaty signing charade of 1835, wrote that we all become bones, all of us, articulating that despite the violence of the invading British, any claim to superiority and authority would eventually be pointless. For Bill Baleri, knowing that none of us could escape the fate of becoming bones, he and Alexis Wright offered an ethical construct of coexistence. His ideal was not to be, of course, and today we live with the historical legacy of the violence that followed. Imagination is neither neutral nor a singly progressive concept. We often talk about people having no imagination when they articulate ideas that appear regressive or damaging to others. But they do have an imagination, one that is self-consciously negative and motivated by the destruction of others. Such is the case in a colonial context within Australia, where imagination has been strategically weaponised to disenfranchise and deliberately harm First Nations people. From the latter half of the 19th century onward, the British imagined Aboriginal people in Australia and First Nations communities globally to be primitive and savage in order to justify the killing of whole nations. The British sleight of hand fiction underpinning the invasion and occupation of Aboriginal country that would become Australia, utilised the legal fiction terra nullius to conceive of land unoccupied by any people that might resemble civilization. To claim that country was empty at the same time that land was being stolen by violent dispossession required an imagination that was corrupt and cruel. Similarly, in the following decades into the 20th century, the removal of First Nations children from families and communities relied on an imagination of colonial benevolence, dismissing the basic human rights of Aboriginal people. I want to now highlight a body of writing that exposed this hypocrisy through words and stories too rarely read or heard. The major Aboriginal writers of the late 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century remain largely unknown to us. Their words, written in correspondence to colonial authorities across Australia, are housed in storage boxes in government archives and public libraries. To sit with letters demanding that stolen children be returned to family, that living conditions be improved on government reserves and religious missions, that the colonial promise of land rights be upheld, is a humbling experience. The extensive correspondence written predominantly by women is remarkable for its intellectual and emotional clarity, whereas the reception of the writing amongst colonial authorities reflects an imagination most often devoid of empathy. The complex bureaucratic intervention into the lives and well-being of Victorian Aboriginal people was formally instituted in 1860 with the establishment of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines, the BPA. A suite of government legislative acts during the 1860s and 70s resulted in the majority of Aboriginal people being forcibly concentrated on reserves across the colony by 1880, where children were often separated from parent and family. Housed in a dormitory system, children were provided with religious instruction and basic education to a level, according to one government spokesperson of the time, being that if they can read and write and know how to count their wages, that's all will be necessary of them. As I've previously written in relationship to the government's limited expectations for Aboriginal people, these attempts to curtail Aboriginal self-determination did not go according to plan. By the early 1880s, the now young adults who had been educated for a decade in some cases became activist writers, demanding improved living conditions for themselves and their families. Young Aboriginal adults crafted petitions to government authorities. They penned letters to daily newspapers and wrote directly to local politicians. This writing as activism so alarmed colonial officials that in the early 1880s, the manager of the Lake Tyers Aboriginal Reserve, a Reverend Bulmer, stated that the greatest failure of the BPA was to grant Aboriginal people the power of the written word, for they have surely used it against us. In 1886, as a means of curbing political activism amongst young Aboriginal people, the Victorian colonial government legislated a new Aborigines Act, more commonly known by Aboriginal people as the infamous Half-Caste Act. Time does not permit a detailed analysis of the Act tonight, but two outcomes are pertinent to this conversation. Firstly, the 1886 Act began the process of dividing Aboriginal people into blood quantum categories, including half-caste, quarter-caste and octoroon, allowing authorities to separate so-called mixed-blood agitators from their families and elders. A second primary motivation of the 1886 Act desired an outcome that widespread frontier violence had failed to deliver, being the total extermination of the so-called Aboriginal race. The expectation underpinning the legislation could not have been more clearly stated when a member of the BPA commented, "The pure Aboriginals, of which there are about 300, will be kept until the end of their days. But in the opinion of the board, it is that in the course of a very few years, the whole of the race will have passed away." I'd like us to pause again to consider these chilling words. The whole of them, Aboriginal people, will have passed away. The feigned banality of the phrase, reminiscent of the soothe the dying pillow deception, disguises what would be required for an entire nation to pass away. For such an outcome to succeed, older Aboriginal people, forcibly living on reserves and religious missions, would remain isolated from their own people, entrapped in a macabre display of gradual extinction. Simultaneously, the identities of younger vocal generation of Aboriginal people will be erased with the slight of a legislative pen. In both law and ethics, this violence has a name. It is genocide. Unfortunately, within Australia, genocide remains an unpalatable term when applied to colonial violence against First Nations communities. This is hardly surprising. Nationalism of any sort should be treated with suspicion, and yet it is called upon repeatedly to refute any discussion of colonial genocide. While flag waving, particularly at a sporting event, might be tolerable, it should be sin-binned when discussing the legacy of human rights abuses. Although we have one, Australia is not a football team. Concepts such as the current buzzwords, including social cohesion and truth-telling, require more of us than a tired national anthem defence. As we are aware, the Aboriginal community of Victoria did not pass away as a result of the 1886 Act. In fact, by the first decades of the 20th century, Aboriginal communities were not only surviving but culturally rejuvenating themselves on the same reserves that were supposed to facilitate their end. The writing produced by Aboriginal women in the first decades of the 20th century illustrates the extent of the struggle to simply live, to simply be. Amongst the many hundreds of letters I researched in government archives, the correspondence between one family living on the Framlingham Reserve in the Western District of Victoria and the BPA has remained with me two decades later. The letters concern the removal of a teenage daughter from her mother without explanation. The girl was taken from her mother and sent to the Lake Conda Reserve, also in the Western District, where the girl's family were refused physical contact with her. I'm often asked what it is that I value most as a writer. My answer, to be read, would seem obvious. What I mean in a more considered way is that it would be a terrible experience not to be read, not to have a relationship with a reader. The most intimate moments of our lives as children, family, and friendships are to be read by someone we love. As I expect everyone in this room tonight would agree, to put words on a page as a means of communicating with another person, only to have those words ignored or dismissed, would be a humiliating experience. The Aboriginal women who wrote to government officials in the first half of the 20th century did so with eloquence, dignity, gentle persuasion, and an ethical imagination. The poignancy of their words, for an Aboriginal reader at least, is both heartbreaking and empowering. That some government officials that the women corresponded with ignored their words and that the letters to and from children were sometimes destroyed is a shameful act.
On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Natasha Mitchell. This is award-winning writer, historian, teacher, activist, Professor Tony Burch, with this closing night address that he gave at the Melbourne Writers Festival this year on the ethical imagination and the giving and receiving of writers and their readers.
In the years immediately after World War I, the Framlingham Aboriginal community were in mourning. Men whose own status as both Australian citizens and Aboriginal people had been denied them had volunteered for the AIF. They fought and died in Europe. Their bodies remain in the ground there today. One family who had lost several members in the Great War suffered further indignity at its end when the daughter of a prominent Aboriginal woman was taken from her. Following the child's removal, the mother wrote to the Chief Secretary of the Victorian Government pleading the following for the return of her daughter. Dear Sir, I am thinking about my poor little girl. She is longing to come home again to her own native part. You know that it's quite natural for a child to come home to her own mother and relations. My sister got a letter telling her that Mrs. Galbraith is treating her very unkindly. She knocked her head against the door and she struck her. Mrs. Galbraith is overworking her too much. The girl has to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and scrub before she goes to school, and then she has to work when she comes home again. The mother's words were ignored. She was given no explanation as to why her daughter would not be returned home to her. In addition to writing to government officials, the mother wrote directly to her own daughter. While a copy of this letter is available in the government archive, we have no knowledge if the daughter received the letter, as we also know that the correspondence from family was often withheld from stolen children, lest it render those children over emotional, according to a reserve official at the time. The mother wrote the following words to her child: "My dearest darling daughter, I now write you these few lines hoping it will find you in good health. You don't know how much I long for you. I am always thinking about you. Me and Auntie, also your poor little brothers, they're always saying to me, 'When is our sister coming home again?' All your brothers, they send their love." In addition to the impact on the girl's mother and siblings, other members of her family also suffered. The girl's auntie, who had become unwell while grieving for her niece, also wrote to a government official reminding him of the cruel hypocrisy in recognising the deaths of Aboriginal men who died for king and country so that a nation would be free, then stealing the same men's young family members. The auntie wrote the following letter to a government bureaucrat: "My niece, a girl of 14 years, she was sent to Conda 2 years ago, and when she wanted to come home to her mother, they refused to let her come home, not even to see her mother. And I have heard that she's been treated very harshly by the woman manager, and all her letters are opened. All our dear brave soldier boys got killed at the front. There are none that came back alive. My brother, brother-in-law and uncle and cousin, my nephew, they're all done in there, helping to make Australia free, and this is how you treat us." I'd like us to pause again. Less than 2 weeks ago, Aboriginal elders were booed at Anzac Day commemorations across Australia simply for remembering not only Aboriginal war dead, but all who had served the nation, to quote again, who had served all of us. The hecklers, some organised by far-right agitators, desecrated the lives and memories of heroes who ironically had fought for the freedoms of such cowards. At the same time, we are facing increasing complaints over welcome to country ceremonies. Yes, I too have stood and listened to an auntie or an uncle giving us a little more than we had expected at ceremonies. But so what? The same Aboriginal people who have experienced racism throughout their lives, some who were taken from their families as children, are now welcoming us onto country that colonial Australia attempted to steal from them, such as their generosity. As a response to the Framlingham family's persistent pleas to have their child return, the Victorian government reacted with a level of cruelty reflective of their disregard for the basic humanity of Aboriginal people. The girl was eventually released from the Lake Conda Reserve, but she was not returned to her mother and family. The girl was collected by a government vehicle and transferred to a Salvation Army home in Melbourne, hundreds of miles away from her mother, making it impossible for the family to visit the girl. We do not know if the family ever saw the girl again, although it is unlikely, considering private conversations I've had with relevant family members in recent years. What we do know is that the impact of the girl's removal and eventual banishment devastated the family. In the final correspondence between the child's mother and the government official, the woman wrote, "The weather is cold and my house is very damp. We are hard up for blankets. I need warm blankets. My little kitchen is always very wet and miserable. My sister is crippled for nearly 2 years now and is very thin. She is always suffering." The woman's letter ended with a dignified comment, "My kindest love and best wishes. Please excuse my writing. Please excuse my writing." At the same time, this woman ended her final letter with these four words: "Aboriginal people in Victoria had experienced forced incarceration for 60 years, frontier violence in the east and west of the colony, and the subsequent independent state had been going on for 120 years. And yet this woman asked that her writing be excused. Each letter she penned began with the words, 'Dear Sir.' She and other writers often ask after the health of their jailers and that of his family. Strategically so, I suspect, but still, the comments stand when considering the colonial authorities rarely asked after the well-being of any Aboriginal person or how they might feel about the theft of their child. For instance, William Barrack, a senior leader amongst the Aboriginal community at the Corindoke Reserve east of Melbourne, was once forced to carry his dying son David, a five-year-old boy, through the streets of the city on a cold, rainy night in late 1870s. The boy died a short time later at the Melbourne Hospital on Lonsdale Street. When William Barrick was subsequently questioned during a Royal Commission about the living conditions of Corranderk, no evidence was sought from him about the neglectful conditions on the reserve that would have contributed to the death of his own son. Barrick was only asked if he was a hard worker and how many undershirts did he need each year. It might surprise us then, considering this history of disregard for the intellectual and compassionate depth of our writing, that so many contemporary First Nations authors have produced writing that ethically addresses the shared values of collaboration, reciprocity, protection of country in a time of climate crisis, and the value of constructive communal thinking more generally. Kim Scott, the Jewel Miles Franklin Award winner in his novel That Dead Man Dance, provides an insight into historical attempts to negotiate productive cohabitation between Noongar First Nations people and the British in the early 19th century. Addressing the failure of this brief experiment, Scott provided us with both a cautionary tale and a potential way of seeing a different future in an anomaly post-colonial nation. Alexis Wright, for the complexity of her storytelling, is centrally concerned with the protection of delicately balanced ecologies and the urgent need to care for and defer to country for the benefit of all Australians. While another Miles Franklin winner, Melissa Lukashenko, writes to convey the authority and strength of Aboriginal women confronted by the atrocities of misogyny and violence. Violence that impacts on all women in this country, regardless of ethnicity, class, and gender. Each of these writers and others possess the greatest ethical and imaginative qualities. I'm not suggesting that non-Aboriginal writers are not gifted with such qualities. Many are. We as First Nation writers read them widely. We have been influenced by them and greatly appreciate their work. But when considering the Alexis Wright question raised at the beginning of this conversation, what happens when you tell someone else's story? Aboriginal stories created by Aboriginal people are the vital component of a productive nation that might exist beyond cliche. Witnessing the destructive impact that climate change is having on communities across the globe, First Nations poets are at the forefront of demanding that we face our ecological future with honesty, recognising what we have lost and how we, human and non-human species, might survive. Ali Kobi Ekman, the Aboriginal poet, has written often about the resilience and courage of her country. She has also warned us about the potential death of country when we do harm to it. In her poem, Rust, she writes, "We walk to the river, dying slowly. There is no one to meet us by the circle of trees. We watch canoe trees turning to ghosts. As the water vanishes to rust, we wonder, will the serpent lose its rainbow if the river runs dry?" I want to move to another idea now. The legal scholar Andre Dow is also a novelist. His debut work, Anam, won the Prime Minister's Literary Award in 2024. In a recent essay, The Role of the Writer in an Unfree World, Dow addresses the elephant in every creative room at the moment, including this one, in posing the question, what is the role of the writer after October 2023? In the last 2.5 years, writers both within Australia and internationally have been given both general advice and more direct instruction as to what we as writers should do, say and write in the aftermath of the killing of over 1,200 mainly Jewish people in Israel on the 7th of October and the taking of more than 250 hostages and the following ongoing war on Gaza, which has killed tens of thousands of people and destroyed entire cities. Any writer entering the landscape of war marked by murder and atrocity must do so with the utmost caution. Such a writer should firstly interrogate their own motivation, questioning the validity of their authorial voice and the impact that their writing may have on the wider community. More acutely, before writing a word, we must consider the impact of our writing on those living with the trauma of war and violence. Robert Mann, the eminent scholar and Jewish Australian, recently wrote about the unbearable suffering that followed the Bondi massacre of 15 Jewish people. He also condemned what he referred to as the Hamas-led monstrous attack on October 7, 2023. He then condemned the deaths of up to 70,000 people in Gaza, including at least 20,000 children. Mann additionally warned us about the weaponization of tragedy more generally. I believe his criticism was directed at politicians, journalists, lobbyists, and writers with a greater interest in advancing a polemical argument or political maneuvering than conveying empathy for victims of war. Mann's essay was thoughtful and quietly persuasive. It was also deeply ethical. The response to the Bondi massacre by the Commonwealth government includes the idea that we might address the rise of anti-Semitism and threats to the fabric of social cohesion by focusing on the educative value of Australia's adherence to the concept of the fair go. After all, we live in the greatest country on earth, a wide brown land where politicians believe tolerance is best achieved by utilising a slogan rather than initiating responsible policy. The fair go is a myth we use to mask any serious critique, not only of anti-Semitism, but colonial violence, misogyny, and racism at a wider level. The belief that we might address the complex issues of racism and violence by way of a jingle is blind to reality. Thomas Mayo, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man who campaigned tirelessly for the yes vote during the failed Indigenous constitutional recognition campaign, immediately saw through the government's lack of understanding. His essay in the monthly, The Terror of Silence, discussed the history of indifference surrounding racist violence against First Nations people. The harrowing example he presents should leave us in no doubt that when it comes to racism in Australia, commentary and sentiment are selective. Mayo writes about an incident in June 2024 when the step-nephew of the Northern Territory's Attorney General ran down two Aboriginal people in a speeding vehicle, killing one of them. In a series of text messages to friends, the driver wrote the following: "They were rolling all around the road like bitches when I looked into the rearview mirror, and maybe if I'm lucky, I'll be able to claim his Centrelink for taking out another oxygen thief." The driver was found guilty of causing the deaths. He was sentenced to 5 months home detention and a 12-month community corrections order. I've occasionally commented on the violence of the last 2.5 years in the Middle East, while hopefully remaining thoughtful enough to accept I have limited right to comment on a situation I cannot begin to imagine ethically or otherwise, let alone write about. Considering the role of the writer in our current climate, Dow believes that the committed writer rejects social cohesion and rejects the social contract, where that contract is oppressive, where it is obtained under duress. For Dow, the role of the writer and that of literature itself is to make the world more rather than less free. His essay is also persuasive in part because, as with Robert Mann's work, it is absent of noise, the clatter of rhetoric, making pointed demands that also lack serious thought. Dow and Mann ask that we think and act in more considered ways. They do so with respect for the writing process itself. Other writers and commentators have raised the volume when discussing the place of the writer in our troubled times. Following the initial cancellation of the novelist and academic Randa Abdel Fattah's invitation to Adelaide Writers' Week earlier this year, Booker Prize-winning novelist Richard Flanagan, condemning the decision, quoted his oft-quoted remark, quoting the oft-quoted Franz Kafka, that writing is the axe that smashes the frozen sea within. Not wishing to disagree with two relatively literary heavyweights, including one who could turn me into a giant fly with a stroke of a quill, we do not always need an axe. We can decide that sometimes it is best not to write a word. As much as we might think that we can influence and hopefully progress public debate, this belief is nothing more than self-serving hubris. Writers must accept that it may not be our time to write. I have spoken publicly about the war against Gaza on two occasions since October 2023. Once at the 75th anniversary of the infamous Nakba, and on another occasion outside the State Library of Victoria, where we condemned the killing of more than 200 journalists covering the war. Having a platform to write doesn't mean that we should climb onto it. Most writers, thankfully, are voracious and generous readers. We are also generally good listeners. In the last 2 years, I've read and listened closely to both Palestinian and Jewish writers and learned far more from them than I could by writing a word myself. Hence, perhaps, as I said at the beginning of this talk, I may be standing here as a walking, talking contradiction, but that I'll leave for you to judge. I would like to end by returning to writing as an act of courage and the place of an ethical imagination within storytelling. Over the last 2.5 years, I've constantly been reminded of the many weeks I spent with pencil and paper in the archives reading the words of Aboriginal women. I thought often about one woman in particular, Mrs. R, who lived at the Framlingham Reserve. Mrs. R wrote letters of protest to members of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines for 40 years. She campaigned for improved rations, the rights of her family, many who had been forcibly exiled from the reserve. She also campaigned for medical treatment for her ailing husband. Towards the end of her life, the cottage where Mrs. and Mr. R had been living for decades mysteriously burnt to the ground. Mrs. R retrieved several lengths of roofing iron from the remains of the fire and constructed a lean-to humpy for her and her husband to live in. Knowing that the family faced destitution, the Victorian government made two decisions, both indicative of their cruel treatment of the family. Firstly, in consultation with local police, Mrs. R was charged with the cost of illegally acquiring the twisted sheets of iron that had been on the roof of her own home. Secondly, she was sent a pair of one-way rail tickets informing her that she and her husband were to be removed from Framlingham and sent to the Lake Tyers Aboriginal Reserve on the other side of the state, hundreds of miles away from her country and extended family. Mrs. Rowling returned the rail tickets to the government official along with a letter written in the plainest but most direct English. I expect nothing from you but the right to die on my homeland. Thank you.
Powerful testimony and themes that echo throughout his writing. That was Tony Burch, historian, teacher, writer of books, The White Girl, Blood, Pictures of You and more, and the Bois Bouvier Chair in Australian Literature at the University of Melbourne, with his closing address to the Melbourne Writers' Festival, exploring the ethical imagination. You're with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's wonderful to have you with us. Now, to explore these ideas further, Tony joins his former student, who is now the editor of The Monthly Magazine, former ABC Radio National presenter Michael Williams, in conversation.
You can take a moment to breathe before I ask you your first question.
I'm just going to check the football scores.
Oh, my God. I can't believe that you really did. Carlton winning?
We're not talking about that. Uh-huh.
Okay. Just checking.
You talk about trauma.
You're walking contradiction, Tony.
Yes.
As ever. There was so much in that. It was really kind of absolute textbook Tony Burch. It was thoughtful. It was angry. It was considered. It was both a call to action and also a call to not unnecessary action, which I think is an interesting kind of tension. I want to start, though, with that extraordinary writing of the 19th century that you spent so much time in the archives of. Because of its invisibility in our institutions, in our historical record, in our education system now, that these are voices that haven't been cancelled, they've just not been silenced or allowed to be heard. Do you see any sign of that improving? Do you see any way that our institutions understand, for all we talk of truth-telling, how do we get those voices back on the record?
There's a bit of a contradiction because I should say at the outset, there are some historians who have done remarkable work on these letters. So I think 2 decades ago, Pat Grimshaw and Elizabeth Nelson, both from the History Department of Melbourne University, did a substantial book on some of the letters. I'm sure other scholars have worked on them. I know they have. And certainly Aboriginal community members are now doing a lot of work on their own family in the archives. So it's not as if they're buried and not seen. I think what's indicative of the problem we have in Australia, but people might not understand, we only get to tell a story once. So people say, well, it's important to listen to Aboriginal people, and let's say it's important to read these letters, but there's still a terrible history of you get a chance to speak once, but you've spoken, you don't need to speak again, you can go home now. So there's no traction with them, or there's not a growth where you look at it as a body of work that then becomes a really important narrative that... So if you look at history generally, and I did a PhD at Melbourne University, if you look at, say, historians working on a new idea around a new body of work, you can trace the genealogy of that and the growth that it becomes, say, a major idea in 10 years' time. That doesn't happen. So you will get someone like me give a presentation like tonight and people go, wow, that's an important story. And again, other people have done this. It's not exclusively my realm, but it never seems to be taken up with greater energy. I think this very seriously. My greatest anger about the current situation, whether it's regard to the response of you know, something like Bondi, whether it be regard to what Thomas Mayo was talking about, is that I honestly, and I know people may disagree, I don't think Australia is a mature, intelligent, intellectual nation to deal with these things in a proper ongoing way. And I think that intellectually, these issues are paid lip service to. So a really good example would be, and I understand when you think of nationalism, of course nationalism is, there are cliches, but when the government talked about, you know, social cohesion, we need to teach kids in school about the fair go. I mean, that's so stupid. Yeah. And that I said at the time to people, well, what does that mean? Will you critique it or will you just present it? Because it's clear they're saying, we just have to remind them of what a great country this is and how we can be better, and this is not us. Now, in regard to Bondi, that's a terrible, exceptional event, but the fact that this is not us in the sense that we don't have a racist history is ridiculous. And to say that is still an affront to some people. And my work as a historian and a writer is to say, this is something that we need to really look at, that we need to look in the mirror, and we need to stay with it until we've dealt with it. And a really good example with me would be to think about misogyny, would be to think about sexism. Yeah, imagine if I was, say, and I've got four adult daughters who may be here tonight, but to say, well, oh, but that's not me, I'm not like that, this is these few men over here on the side. No, this is a societal problem. This is endemic. This is part of our fabric as a society. And unless we look at it and look at it for a long time, it's not going to change. So I think in relationship to the issue of racism and the violence against Aboriginal people, it's never dealt with. And here's a really tangible example. Yeah, so there's a Royal Commission going on at the moment, and you think, oh, hopefully something of value comes out of it. I wouldn't get too hopeful. If you look at all the Royal Commissions that have dealt with suffering of Aboriginal people, be it deaths in custody, the most recent example, which is tangible for us tonight, is the Royal Commission into the abuse, torture and mistreatment of Aboriginal children in Northern Territory. That was the Royal Commission that was held after the terrible Dondale exposure on Four Corners, where we saw Aboriginal children being tortured, put in spit hoods, shackled to chairs. We saw film of kids being, you know, kept in 24 hours in concrete blocks with a hose down with cold water. We know that children, Aboriginal children in the Territory, and particularly in West Australia, children as young as 10 can spend 24 hours a day in an adult prison. Now, if you look at the outcome of that Royal Commission, just basically it called for several things: the closure of Dondale, the charges made against those people, the release of children not, and all of those were part of those recommendations. None of those recommendations have come into play.
And within two turns of the political cycle, you can have a new government who campaigned on restoring spitterhoods, for example.
And that you should be able to say to a person, if you consider Australia to be the greatest country on earth, how do you feel about that?
But how do you counter, I mean, leave aside the ethical part of it, the imaginative part of it, how do you counter that kind of national myth building that, as you say, is so fraudulent? I mean, if the fair go is central to some kind of bogus idea of Australian values, the other phrase that springs to mind is she'll be right, the kind of shrugging off the laissez-faire, things will work it out. How do you translate anger, injustice into people's conception of the country they live in?
Well, it might seem, again, I don't want to contradict myself, but it's weird to say that you can find examples where people show great care to others. And that's, I talked about the writing of Aboriginal people who have written about the great potential of cooperation that sort of get snuffed out. I'm sure everyone in this room tonight could think about instances in their own life where people have shown remarkable care to them and gone beyond. People have given up, you know, wealth. The people who have acted with courage and bravery, with empathy. So it's not for a moment suggesting that we don't do that. My view is that if we were to say, okay, look at what that means to care for other people, to act with care, we need to find ways that that becomes not an exception and it doesn't also become an example of that's what we are writ large, is to say, okay, if there's a bit better way to be, we can, as storytellers, we can look at those examples to show us the way forward. Now, I did talk about Kim Scott's work, but this is probably the most tangible real history example. When I talked about William Barrack before, the manager of the Coranduck Aboriginal Reserve, Mr. Green, who was an Anglican minister at the time of that Royal Commission, he was regarded so highly by Aboriginal people. They loved him and he loved them. And when they held the Royal Commission, when he stood up in the dock and gave evidence, they asked him how he thought about looking after Aboriginal people in a sort of demeaning, patronising way. And he said, these men and women are my brothers and sisters. And there was this audible gasp in the room and he was dismissed from Coranduck. So historically, and I talked to the late and great Jack Charles about this, you could look at the relationship between Charles Green and William Barrack and say, okay, yeah, that is a great example of cooperation. So it's not to say we don't teach that, but that needs to be something that we think, well, how can we be that and not something else? So as a writer, I think I have limited ability to have any serious impact. I'm sceptical of that. I said to the schools group here on Friday, yeah, when people say things like, does writing change the world? I used to think that. And then what you would realise, and historically any older people would realise, it only takes one or two men who are mad to really do serious damage to the whole world. And, yeah, your writing is up against that incredibly powerful, regressive, violent forces. So it's a very difficult...
Good to see you're still demotivating rooms of students, Tony.
No, you weren't there. I put a couple of jokes in there and that lifted. I mean, but to say that, I think, again, to think about, you know, there's a contradiction in being a writer. If you don't want to be too egotistical, if people say, is your writing going to change the world? If writer goes, yeah, it is, you know, it's a bit much.
But, I've heard you say that many times.
In the mirror every morning. But as a reader, I could say my life has been changed profoundly by those women who wrote those letters. So their impact on me as a person, when people say, oh, we're having this difficulty and that difficulty, I say, hang on, I'll show you this woman who sat at a kitchen table in a tin hut in Framlingham with a pencil and a brown envelope, and she wrote a letter, stuck in an envelope and demanded that her kids be returned to her. That's courage. What you've got to do is not that difficult.
But also, I mean, that's absolutely right. As a reader, and I imagine every person in this room feels the same way, the impact, the change, the, for lack of a better phrase, the imaginative change performed by you in your writing, but also the other writers you cited in your talk tonight, is kind of immeasurable. Like, it's huge. It defines my intellectual, emotional, compassionate life, I think. Now, that doesn't mean it changes the world wholesale, but that, nor does it mean it's meaningless.
No, I suppose when you say, I wonder what book, I wonder what's on Donald Trump's bedside table, what's he reading? It'll be pictures of him on the front, I know that much. That is the dilemma, because, yes, of course, my whole life is... You know, I've talked about this before. I got my first library card when I was 5 years of age and I've been a voracious reader ever since, and I love reading. I love reading more than I do being a writer. I love reading, and I've read widely. I've learned so much. And yes, it's my life is profoundly impacted by writing. So I believe that. I mean, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I suppose that, you know, to quote Richard Flanagan again, it's a bit more favourably this time, he once referred to himself as a constructive pessimist. So I'm not very optimistic as a person in the sort of the greater scheme of things, but two things, it doesn't stop me doing what I'm doing. I suppose a good example for people, I had a professorial fellowship for 5 years just working on climate justice. And, you know, we're in a terrible, dangerous situation that's going to get worse. So when I would talk to students, they would say, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? And I thought, I'm not going to say. But the truth was, I'd say, and this is what I believe, the same with my writing generally, whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic is actually irrelevant. The work is what matters. Do the work, write the books, find readers, engage with a public, and you hope that that energy of writing trickles out. And I know it's a cliche, but if you drop the pebble in the pond and the ripples, that's one. And the other thing is that I meet a lot of readers at, you know, libraries. And by the way, if you want me to come to your library, I will not come unless I get a creamed Leamington. There's got to be fresh cream. That's my only fee.
It's a good writer.
So, say a book like mine, The White Girl, that sells really well. It's taught in a lot of schools. So I have no knowledge of the impact on that book on the majority of readers. I don't know what it's doing out there. It's got its own life. When I go and talk to schools, which I probably do about a dozen schools a year in my Bois-Bivier, by the way, not Boyce, Bois-Bivier, it's the only word in French I know.
Excellent.
And you've got to know because they gave you a job.
Yeah.
Is that the kids that I, and this probably is something that might be helpful to us, I talk to schools groups a lot and that gives me enormous optimism. Yeah, teenagers get bagged a lot and they're all on social media and they're all doing this. The students that I speak to on Friday, schools that I visit, the kids, they're smart, they're remarkable, they're angry that we aren't doing enough, but they're fully engaged. I got an email this morning maybe from a teacher from Hampton Park, the high school, who was part of this 8 schools group on Friday. I called them out a couple of times and had a beautiful question from a woman, a young student who said, want to know about country. And I said, where are you from? And I knew she had a head hijab on, so she, her family from the Middle East. I said, well, tell me about your country, and I'm interested in that. And the teacher wrote this for me and said, it was wonderful that you engaged with our school. This is a school of, you know, kids, often ESL refugee students. To you to recognise them was so uplifting for them. So those relationships with young people, I do feel very optimistic about them.
You are, like, I do think amongst the writers I know and I've had the chance to work with, you do have a clear, palpable sense of personal responsibility, of how to use your stage, how to use the opportunity that you have because you have this voice, that you need to do it. And that's why you talk to schools. You touched upon this in your talk, but I want to dig into that idea of responsibility a bit further, because you're right, the climate is fucked, there's injustice everywhere, there's all this stuff. Do you feel either a personal responsibility or part of a collective responsibility?
Look, what I feel very strongly is that I have a really good job at Melbourne University. It's an endowed chair. It deliberately wants you to do public engagement, and I love it. I actually think it's a dream job because I still get to do some writing, maybe not as much as I thought I would, but I've been in this position now for 3.5 years and I've got 18 months to go. I've got a formal partnership with a secondary school. I teach into the medical school, teaching narrative medicine, teaching to the law school. And I think I'm blessed to be able to do that. And one of the things I say is to think, you know, the word privilege has been thrown around a lot in recent years in a negative. To be a published author is such a privilege in a very positive sense. So I feel incredibly fortunate. And I feel really strongly, I feel deeply responsible for what I write. And I feel responsible not only to readers at festivals, I feel really deeply responsible to those students. So if I go out to a school and there's 150, you know, year 10 or year 11 students who have read The White Girl, you know, I'm always of the view I've got to be on my game, I want to be engaged with them. And it is a responsibility. And the other thing is that if we think in an altruistic way at all, and people who know me know that I can be a bit egotistical, yeah, when it comes to being the best 69-year-old runner in Melbourne and things like that. So I'm not, people will always say, are you nervous about tonight? I don't get nervous or anything like that. But I think you've got to be humble about, your audience. You've got to be respectful of them. And you've got to do two things. And one is, people say to me, what do you enjoy most about being a writer? It is seriously that writers and readers have this weird relationship. Sometimes it's like this in public. But again, the majority of your relationship, you're up in your room writing away, and then you make the book, and then a reader buys it in the shop and they go home. You have this very intimate connection, but you don't know each other. And you don't know what they're doing. You know, I'm always intrigued. I've seen people reading my book on the tram a couple of times, and I've looked at them, and are they smiling? Are they grimacing? Yeah, what are you doing looking out the window? You should be reading. But I love that not knowing, because that allows you to be more humble than egotistical. You can't demand to know. And knowing that the book has its own life, I really love. And the other one is that if it's, and I don't think it's being egotistical, if I'm able to affirm, yes, I think what I do matters, and I think what I do can be impactful on people, I don't need to be told that.
But that does mean that people look to you for moral or ethical guidance. I mean, you raised...
Me?
Let's say writers, of which you are one. I mean, you raised the cancellation of Rhonda from Adelaide Writers Week this year. And
that was well handled, wasn't it?
It was in the pantheon of disastrous institutional choices in this country, which is a deep bench, sadly. But one of the things that characterised that was a collective response from the writers who were in the program. They felt that they had a power and an opportunity with their voice and with their decision not to attend that festival after that decision was made, and that that was something they had not just a right to do, but a responsibility to do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about that kind of collective responsibility to a set of ideas?
Okay, there's a couple of things. I won't go into detail, but there's a major dispute at the moment between a group of writers and University of Queensland Press over Jazz Money's children's book. And I've been part of a loop of conversations about what's happening and where to go, and people have decided to leave UQP. I actually left UQP over a year ago, so I didn't have to make a decision. People have looked to me in that loop, I think, as a senior writer. I don't know if they see me as moral authority, but they look to me. And I responded yesterday with an email, and basically my response, which may surprise some people because I'm seen as an activist, I said, look, when I left UQP over what I thought was a strong matter of principle, which I won't go into, I did so without any publicity. I wrote to the three other writers who I felt had been treated really appallingly. I said I was leaving, and I said I didn't expect those writers to follow me at all, and I didn't want them to. I also said, I can do this. I've got a brand. I'm well known. It won't be hard to find another publisher. And I did very easily. I've got a full-time salary. I'm financially secure. So all the things that allowed me to leave were an easy decision for me. If I was a young emerging writer, if I was a single, and I know single parents who are writing and they live off grant to grant, that'd be a much tougher decision to make. And what I said in the email yesterday was, if anyone decides they want to stay with the publisher, if anyone decided they wanted to stay with a writer's festival, because we know that several young emerging writers who would have had their books for the first time discussed with an audience at Adelaide didn't get the opportunity to do that. I said, if anyone makes the decision to stay or do, none of us should judge that person. So while we might make a collective decision, any person who decided not to be part of that decision shouldn't be criticised in any way. And I really firmly believe that. In regard to Adelaide, I think I can understand why everyone went through, because it was such a messy, appalling thing to do. And I think what was done to Rhonda was wrong. And I would have withdrawn. I wasn't invited to the festival. But there are a couple of other things I think that I have thought about a lot of this as a writer. If I were approached to be at a festival and they asked me to go on a panel, and if I objected to another writer for the sorts of reasons that have come out in the last couple of years, I would say, and I say this with honesty, I wouldn't want to make it a political statement about me. And let's say we're thinking about the Middle East, we're thinking about real trauma where people have suffered horrifically. Why would I want me to become the news? That to me is egotistical. And my decision would be different. I would probably, and I talked to the director here, Ronnie, who's wonderful. If I felt that I didn't want to appear with a person, I would just quietly say to Ronnie, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do it. And I would withdraw. Or if I thought a festival was so abhorrent because they'd invited some person I really strongly and morally disagree with, I wouldn't make a public demand that that person be withdrawn. I would withdraw because, to me, the ultimate issue is, well, if I feel that this person is someone who I don't want to platform, well, then I'll just say I'll stay home. And I don't need to make the public statement. So I think that is really important. But I think this is the thing that I think I would like to say that is frustrating for me and frustrating for many writers. We've sort of been the centre of attention and we don't want to be the centre of attention. So in my case, I have been involved sort of at the fringes of three issues in the last 2.5 years. One is at University of Queensland Press. And again, I left and made no public statement and will not, although I've just mentioned it, although it has been in the press
that... Keep it to yourselves.
Yeah. It has been in the press that this happened.
This has been broadcast on Radio National.
Yeah, okay. Secondly was an issue that occurred at the State Library of Victoria, which people know about. And thirdly was a proposed collaborative poetry event at the Melbourne Writers' Festival, I think in 2023 or 4, between Palestinian and Aboriginal poets, and it did go ahead. The thing about those three things, and if we take Adelaide as another example, and I talked to the wonderful Jean Smith from UQP today, so I still have great friendships at UQP, is that what I want people to think about is these decisions that were made, anyone would know, say with Adelaide, this is really going to cause a ruckus, right? So you imagine the board of the Adelaide Writers' Festival say we're going to disinvite Rhonda. And whether it was the Premier who pulled the strings, we don't know. But, okay, we're going to disinvite her. You can't imagine that those people sat around that room and didn't say, and this is going to, the shit's going to hit the fan. There's going to be trouble, right? That would be obvious. I think the same at the State Library. I think the same at UQP. I think the same at the Venice Biennale. I think the same at Creative Australia. All these things at the Melbourne Symphony, all these things that have happened. In all of these instances, what happened after that was nothing. So the point being here, the Adelaide Writers' Festival did not get on the front foot and explain why it was happening and keep the discussion about it open. All of these organisations closed down and stopped talking. And I've heard people say about one of the disputes, oh, we don't want to say anything because it could cause legal action. And you think, well, if you cancelled someone and you did it wrongly, that comes with the turf. So I've always thought that in all of these things that people who have made decisions have then not been willing enough to be responsible for the outcome and to speak openly about that. And again, I think it's required of us if we think that there's something we disagree with. So if for instance, I did disagree with another writer, I would talk to them. Someone said to me after the poetry event, oh, why won't you appear on stage with a Jewish writer or an Israeli writer? And I said, well, I've appeared on stage with many Jewish writers over the years. Some are great friends of mine. Some are just other writers. I would appear with an Israeli writer. I don't program festivals. You know, and I would hope that my judgment would be such that within reason, I would share a stage with any person I'm in conflict with. And that to share a stage with someone you're in conflict with, and if you have a respectful conversation, one or two things happens. How you felt might be even solidified, or you realise after engaging with a person that you have a disagreement with, hang on, there's something here I need to think about. There's something here I can learn from.
Just to kind of summarise, are you saying that the failure of these institutions is shocking because that's not who we are as a nation, because we believe in the fair go?
Oh, that's very, very funny. No. I'll say this, which I said to Ronnie, two things. I think, again, to take that first point more seriously than you did, Michael, I think if you make those sorts of decisions, you need to do not only with great responsibility, you need to justify them. And that's really justify them. But I think the other thing that frustrates me is that it disrespects the maturity of audience. And that's more important. No one is asking, what do these people think? So if we were to say, okay, we're going to program a writer who's controversial for whatever reason, and there are different controversies, and we might disagree with them, the audience needs to be able to listen to that person or decide not to. And I think that what all of these decisions have done, they have disregarded the maturity, the intellect, and the generosity of audiences. So I've been going to writers' festivals for probably 15 years. I've been in sessions where it's got really heated, not from me, of course, and the audiences have really held the event together because the audiences are the energy of the room. So in my case, I think a lot of this has been done, whether it be anyone lobbying, whether it be writers arguing, has been done for a disregard of the community. And again, to take that point of the fair go seriously, this is the potential, because you asked about what's the potential. Let's say we were to say, to what extent is Australia, could it be considered a land of a fair go? Now, I might get on stage with Angus Taylor, maybe not. But the point being is that what I have said to you tonight as an audience, you might disagree with some of what I've said, and that's not only you're right, that's what we're doing here, okay? And the point being is that I've got to test myself by being able to defend that position against a person who may hold a very different position. And then the audience, based on those different viewpoints, will go home, hopefully, with a lot to think about. So if we're more mature as a festival, which this one is, I think it's been a great festival, if we're more mature as boards, as directors, as writers, the audience will benefit because people will leave here, or not tonight because we're too much in agreement with each other, people would leave here thinking, and they carry on the discussion, and that's what then spins into something of possibility. So to have really productive, open dialogue, debate, and I mean really healthy debate. When I went to Melbourne University, which is in 1988, and it doesn't happen anymore, universities have changed, because I'd come from a family where none of us finished high school. If we got to Form 4, we found a way to get expelled, which I did. But the point being, when I went to university in 1988, I just loved it. I mean, I loved it because the vigorousness of tutorial discussions where you'd have in those days, we'd have a debate, and then you'd walk out and people would want to continue that discussion over coffee and stuff. I loved that. And all I learned through that different opinions are what, in the end, change us. So if we want to make a claim about how great Australia is and we just need to tune into the fair go and all troubles we've got will go away, we need a strong debate about that.
You opened tonight's talk expressing an anxiety that you might end up contradicting yourself, but actually I think the thing that makes you such an extraordinary teacher and writer is your capacity to hold multiple things to be true at the same time and to write and talk with real integrity to that truth. And I think audiences, Writers Festival audiences, readers, hold multiple things to be true at once, and we are lifted up and we benefit from that, and we benefit from you, Tony Burch. Please join me in thanking Tony Burch.
Thank you. Thank you.
Big thanks today to Professor Tony Burch and host, his former student, Michael Williams, who's the editor of the monthly magazine, for that terrific soul-searching conversation. They were speaking at this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival. Tony is author of novels, short story collections, poetry, including The White Girl, Shadow Boxing, and Ghost River. He is the Bois Bouvier Chair in Australian Literature at the University of Melbourne. I reckon some of his books might end up in this year's Top 100 Countdown, which is coming on up later this year, focusing on the top Australian books of all time. Thanks for listening to Big Ideas, your front row seat to big thinkers at the best live events across Australia and everywhere. Our email address for your reflections, your compliments, your brickbats, bigideas@abc.net.au. My name is Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.